Hey, and welcome to season 2, episode 5 of Foolproof Theology. I am Chase Davis, and I'm really excited to be with you here today. Here on Foolproof Theology, we like to talk about deep theological topics, or at least they're deep to me, because I like learning. We like our theology like I like my bourbon, strong and well-aged. I'm really excited about our guest today, Tony Morita. Tony's a graduate of University of Cumberland's, played shortstop, and also a graduate of New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, where he got his MDiv and PhD. He serves as a pastor of preaching and vision at, is it Imago Dei Church, Tony?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, yes.
In Raleigh, North Carolina. Tony serves as the Dean of Grimke Seminary and Director of Theological Training for Acts 29. He's also a council member of the Gospel Coalition. He's written over 15 books, Christ-Centered Expositor, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, Love Your Church, and other volumes in the Christ-Centered Exposition Commentary Series, which we're actually using at the well right now for our sermon series on Exodus, so that's a real blessing to us. He's happily married to Kimberly, and they have 5 children. Tony, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Hey, Chase. Great to be with you, man.
Well, you know, the way the podcast typically works is I like to hear a little bit more about people's journey, particularly if they have a PhD, and really what they got their PhD in, what their focus was on, and really what sparked their curiosity. So what did you get your PhD in?
Yeah, so I got it in, at New Orleans Seminary, we just called it preaching. In other institutions, they will call it by homiletics or practical theology. I like practical theology better because we in the PhD in preaching, you're studying more than preaching. But PhD in preaching, graduate in 2006.
That's great. And did you know when you graduated with your PhD, did you have a direction or a sense of like, I'm going to be in the academy or I'm going to go plant a church? Or what was kind of your sense back in 2006 of what your next was?
Yeah, well, interestingly, when I first went to seminary, I didn't know if I would even finish my master's degree. I was so intimidated when I got there. As you mentioned, I played ball. I'm a jock and wasn't the greatest student in the world, especially until I became a Christian, which was my sophomore year of college. And then I started taking my education seriously. And so when I went to seminary, I was just, I always say, ignorance on fire. Very passionate about the Lord. Didn't know anything. Was very intimidated. I still remember the my first class receiving the syllabus thinking, I don't think this is for me. And had a friend that encouraged me to stay at least one semester. And I ended up staying and doing several degrees. But I did my MDiv quickly. It was a 90-hour MDiv, but I was able to do it in 2.5 years. I was taking a ton of hours. And after my first semester, just really dove right in. And I was taking, you know, winter break courses, spring break courses. And then when I got to the end, I was kind of like, I still want to keep learning. I wasn't married. Wasn't even close to getting married, actually. I was preaching on weekends. I was doing a lot of youth camps, youth events. That was kind of my ministry at that time. And so I decided to keep on going. I did my MDiv in biblical studies. So I did a lot of languages and really loved particularly New Testament Greek. And that's really where my heart was. I felt a little bit inadequate, though, particularly at the languages compared to the guys who were going into the PhD in New Testament. And but I was recruited by our theology prof. He told me I should do theology. And I really chose preaching because for a simple reason, a very practical reason. I tried to envision myself teaching somewhere. And what is it that I could do instinctively that would, and what is it that's needed in theological education at the time? And what I found is what I think is pretty common even now, a lot of folks who are teaching homiletics or preaching in seminaries that we would commend, a lot of them don't have a PhD actually in preaching or homiletics. They have a PhD in New Testament or Old Testament. They just happen to be good preachers or something along those lines. And I started thinking about like, who would you want to study under if you were going to do a PhD in preaching? And for me, I may have not analyzed this well, but it was a pretty short list. But when I thought about who would I want to study the New Testament under? It was a long list, or theology. It was a long list. And so I just thought, well, I'm really a preacher first. I feel like we need more voices and more thought in this area, and it needs to be taught by guys who are preaching regularly. And so that's a long journey, kind of how I got into it. And once I got into the PhD, I found that my areas of interest still remained biblical studies, still remained in theology and history. And so I'm not an overly mechanical teacher when it comes to preaching. I really like to study the theology of preaching, the spirituality of preaching, the history of preaching, preaching from various genres of literature, how to preach Christ from all the scriptures. That tends to be my focus. And I still have a secret dream to do a PhD in New Testament. I've been talking to Mike Bird, who teaches in Australia, he and I are friends, about one day doing it. And he keeps challenging me on my Greek. And I'm like, I don't have time, Mike. I don't have time. But we have a secret dream to excavate Colossae, which hasn't been excavated yet. And so I would love to do that one day.
That's awesome. Yeah. Greek is the one subject when I got my MDiv that made me cry in the parking lot, cause I was so overwhelmed with how stupid I seemed, and understanding how it worked. And we were talking about time, and it was blowing my mind how different cultures and languages, deal with time. And so, yeah, I totally understand with being intimidated in an MDiv. But when you did your dissertation, you were focusing, if I'm remembering correctly, your dissertation on John Piper and his Christ-centered exposition. Is that right?
Yeah. So toward the end of my MDiv, I started getting interested in redemptive historical interpretation of the Bible. So, you know, not just studying with a magnifying glass, as Brian Chappell says, but with a wide angle lens as well. And it's really, it's the integration, the combination of biblical theology, which studies these themes, which have escalation and the climax in Christ, integrating that with traditional inductive Bible study or expository preaching thought. How do we preach a text, but make sure we're preaching Christ legitimately, naturally, from all of Scripture? And I haven't been taught that very much. And so I had a real interest in that. When I got into the actual program, my advisor said it was too broad. Biblical theology is a big subject, and there are various views on biblical theology historically. The same with expository preaching. We got 3,000 definitions of it. And so they said you should take one representative preacher, look at one representative theorist. And so I took Brian Chappell and his book, Christ-Centered Preaching, and I analyzed John Piper's sermons from six genres of literature. So I did about 112, I think, sermon analysis to see how he preached Christ from the various various genres of literature. Back in the day, interesting side note, I started the program in about 2003. I emailed Brian Chappell and I said, who should I study? I need a subject to study. And of course, I loved Piper back then. And he said, there's this guy in New York, his name's Tim Keller. And not many people know about him. And it was just fascinating. I said no, because you couldn't find his sermons back then. And if I had it to do over, if I could have gotten those sermons, that would have been a really enjoyable study, because Keller's taught me a ton over the last 10 years. But I needed access to sermons. I needed proof that these were the real manuscripts, which they said at Desiring God websites that, yeah, this is what John takes to the pulpit. He's edited them some with his pen or whatever, but they're legitimate. So I analyzed those sermons. It was an edifying project. The PhD, I had about 8 seminars, and then I had to write the dissertation. And we went through Hurricane Katrina. I was in New Orleans, and I was pastoring at the time. Yeah, by the time I got into my PhD, I was pastoring in the city. And I'd gotten married by then, and we were just, we bounced around about 6 different houses, because we couldn't find a house to buy. Our place got total. We were in an apartment before the storm.
My goodness.
So it was a wild time to write a dissertation, and I was trying to write every Friday on my day off, and I just didn't have energy some weeks. So I was happy to get it finished. As my friend David Platt, put it, we went through a PhD together. He said, a good dissertation is a finished dissertation.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, amen. You know, you start the program and you want to set the world on fire. And about halfway in, you're like, I just want to get this thing done, man.
That's right.
But it was great. Looking back, the PhD was great, but my MDiv was more formative. It was more enjoyable. And part of that was just me, how I arrived. I was just very, again, ignorance on fire, and it was formative for me. I still have, again, desire to do some deeper biblical studies, and may do that. I've looked around here. We got a lot of options at, you know, like UNC, at Duke. I just need someone to fund me about $50K, and I could do that.
For sure. I actually encountered, when I was doing my THM, I actually encountered the same problem. My scope was so broad. And so it sounds like a similar method of analysis where they said, you need to pick someone and then pick another guy to analyze that someone. And so that's why I did mine analyzing James K. Smith with the theology of John Frame. Because I was just going like, I want to attack discipleship and spiritual formation. And I remember my advisor just laughing at me in a good, helpful way, like, you know, kind of mocking me like, that's ridiculous, you young guy. Like, you can't do that. That's not what this is.
That was a new way of thinking for me when I got into the PhD. My first seminar was on the theology of evangelism. So I had five seminars in preaching, three in theology. And my first paper, I chose to write on the destiny of those who've never heard the gospel. And I was going to write on the different views. And my prof said, don't just write on the four views, take a representative of each view, because you can't defend yourself very well if you're just writing on views in general, because there's going to be a variety of thought within those views, right? So that was my very first tutorial in learning how to, I guess, do some more critical writing than I had done before.
For sure. Now, how much of your kind of thinking and preaching and exposition, does it have overlaps with Van Hooser's kind of method of canonical, the drama of redemption, or is Chappell's method a little bit different than Van Hooser? Do you know?
There would be similarities. I tend to take a biblical theology. How did I say this? When I teach Christ-centered preaching, most people, when they hear this, they think kind of typological methods. Mm-hmm. Jesus is the true and better this or that, which is fine. I think that's legitimate in many cases. But the safer road, as Dever and Gilbert have a chapter on this in their book Preach, when they talked about Spurgeon, every road led to Rome, every road leads to the cross, but some roads may lead you in a ditch. Like, it's not a good road. You need some safe roads to travel on. And I think biblical theology is a safe road that can always get you to Christ, meaning that within any text, you're in a particular unit or section that's highlighting a mega theme. And I think one of the jobs of the expositor is to simply identify which mega theme are you in. D.A. Carson says there are like 20 mega themes in the Bible. And I think that's a safe road. Now, you can do more than that, but I in terms of teaching guys how to think through this process, I want to think in terms of the more obvious connection that's there than trying to be, you let your imagination run wild, which can happen sometimes in this realm of thought. And so I'm looking for a theme that's already embedded in the text. And so it's less about where is Jesus in like Joshua 2:1, but rather what's going on in Joshua chapters 1-6. When I'm in 2:1, I'm able to identify kind of what's happening. And I think it's within those mega themes that you can then make a real strong Christ connection. So that's one focus. Chappell talks some about that. There are two things really I liked about Chappell's method. One is he talks about another safe road, which is just simply asking the question, where does this text stand in relation to Christ? And so you're just simply looking at the flow of history. So you're saying context is everything, whole Bible context as well. So that canonical reading that you mentioned. And then he highlights another safe road, which you may just call it systematic theology, where you're looking for the character of God who provides redemption, or the nature of humanity who require redemption. And so when I'm preaching Judges, I'm looking at the sinfulness of humanity. This is why we need a redeemer. Or when we look at Kings and you look at the decline of Israel, we need a better king. We need redemption. So I think it's those big categories that I find especially helpful.
Okay, that's great. That's really helpful. Kind of the last question I have, specifically related to kind of your area of expertise, because when I was at Denver, the Christ Center preaching wasn't the main emphasis. It was kind of a Haddon Robinson big idea, some Andy Stanley type stuff, which was really helpful for me because being in Acts 29, it's very Christ Centered preaching, so it just gave me different tools. But I started picking up resources just on the side to supplement, because I was kind of getting one take. And one of those resources, and you're going to have to help me with his name, I think it's Sidney Gridenhouse.
Gridenhouse.
Is that how you say it? Gridenhouse.
I don't know if that's correct. I've never asked him personally, but yeah.
Well, I'm gonna take it from you. He does a lot of like Christ-centered preaching from the Old Testament. I think that's what he calls it. Is his method similar to the method you would employ?
Yeah. He has a more wooden method that's really helpful. Some guys I know have literally taped his seven steps onto their desk where they write their sermons. And so it's similar in that you're looking first at your immediate context. You're looking for the theme in that text, and you're going to build a sermon around it. And then you are expanding outward to look at themes. I think he calls them longitudinal themes. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of redraft that your outline in light of that phase. But yeah, his book is really good, Preaching Christ from the Old Testament. The middle of the book is on the history of Christ-centered preaching, which is good, but it kind of feels out of place in the book. It's almost like a separate book.
Gotcha.
And I tell guys, I don't want to tell you to skip that, but skip it and go back and read it. Because guys tend to get a little disjointed, I feel like, in the book. But it is one of my favorite ones to commend to guys. And then he has follow-up books on like Preaching Christ from Genesis, Ecclesiastes, and Daniel, and maybe some others, where he takes that methodology that he talks about and shows you how it would work in particular sermons. And those are really good commentaries if you're preaching through those books.
That's great. That's super helpful. Thank you. You know, you mentioned in your MDiv how intimidated you felt and how it was really formative for you. And really, you look back on those years as both trying, but also encouraging and really giving you some direction. Well, now you find yourself at a position where you are the dean of a seminary, which, you know, looking back at who you were back then as a shortstop at Cumberland, it might have surprised you. So my first question, because one of my advisors is the dean of Denver Seminary now, and I still don't know what a dean does. So what is a dean of a seminary?
Well, let's be honest. I'm the dean of a seminary we just started, and the guys appointed me as the dean. And I'm like, "What's a dean?" And they're like, "I don't know. Just wave at people and tell them we have a seminary." And I'm like, "Okay, I'll do that." You know, as an academic dean, you are responsible for you know, curriculum development and a lot of the more administrative academia, ensuring quality of classes and syllabi. And it's going to be different, of course, from school to school. I'll probably rotate out of this position and stay on at Grimke at some point as I'm teaching preaching and pastoral theology currently. Plan on continuing to do that as long as I can. But we're going to need, as the school grows, this is going to have to be a full-time investment. And we just started bringing on a couple of full-time guys who are dynamite. And so, you know, Grimke's, we have we're shooting for about 140 students this next semester. We had over 100 last year, and that was just after our second semester. So it's doing fantastic. But with the rate of growth, it's kind of like a church plant. You know, a church plant, we're all doing everything. And so, you know, it's all hands on deck. And then as it grows, you're able to do more specialization. So I feel like my dean role has primarily been in the realm of being somewhat of the architect of the curriculum and the model of seminary that we have rolled out and are commending to people. That's been a lot of fun. It's again like a church plant. One of my favorite parts of planting the church was just framing up, you know, who we are, what we want to be about, how do we want to do church, that kind of thing. So I feel like a lot of my work has already been done in terms of giving my opinion and thought about some of the gaps in current theological education and what we need to be known for and kind of the culture of our seminary. And now it's kind of off and running. and we're gonna, as we grow again, we're gonna have to have more hands-on, and I'll probably just kind of step aside and continue teaching. But I've loved it, and we've got a great team. And no, when I went to, I never dreamed I would be doing anything regarding academia as a college baseball player back in the day. In fact, my freshman year, I had a 1.7 GPA. I almost quit. I just wanted to play ball. I was a good player at a small school. You know, I wasn't like going pro or anything like that, but I love the game. Mm. And I wanted to keep playing, and that's why I stayed in school. And I had a reading problem. I was getting tutored in reading my freshman year of college. I'd failed the reading part of the ACT. I could read, but I couldn't comprehend. I couldn't retain stuff.
Okay.
And it just, the work the Lord did in my whole life was just remarkable. And so, yeah, we're still surprised by God's grace.
That's awesome, man. That's awesome. You know, my background growing up was in baseball, and I have a lot of friends that either played in college or something like that. And baseball is really unique, and I think there's an opportunity. I was wondering, as we were talking, if you've ever considered writing a book about kind of lessons you can take from baseball and kind of the way you can approach Christianity. I just think that'd be it may not get a wide audience. It may be a very niche writing, but I'm sure there's a lot of lessons you took from that time. I mean, it's such a formative experience, an embodied experience that trains you, discipline, all that kind of stuff. And it really kind of shapes how you view things.
Oh, absolutely. I've thought about that multiple times. I've thought about writing kind of a lessons learned book. I've also thought about writing a novel, kind of a father and son kind of book, in which you're embedding the lessons into a novel. But yeah, it's interesting right now, Chase. We're transitioning from outdoor service to indoor, and we have a baseball field at our church. And I've been preaching at the pitcher's mound for about a year, and we call it the Sermon on the Mound. And all the people are sitting out in the outfield, and that's where I've been preaching. So we bought this facility that we're in with this field about 4 years ago. So our church is turning 10 years old this year. And we never dreamed we would be using it Sunday by Sunday outside. But yeah, my church is probably tired of baseball illustrations. So I'll apologize sometimes. Like, if you may permit me one more baseball analogy.
That's great.
In fact, I got tickets tonight to go watch the Durham Bulls minor league game, which I hope I get to do. It's raining right now.
That's funny. Yeah, I'm going to see the Frisco Rough Riders tonight. They're a minor league team here in Texas, so that'll be fun. They're playing the Amarillo Sod Puppies. I think that's what their name is. That'll be a good time.
I love that.
Oh, man. Well, kind of going back to Grimke, so being the dean there, you know, seminaries kind of take on kind of the life of the leadership. And I know for like where I was, Denver Seminary, Mark Young came in as the president, and he kind of took a lot of Chris Wright's theology of the mission of God, the Missio Dei, and he wanted that to really inform kind of the history of Denver Seminary, you know, being a very non-denominational, used to be conservative Baptist, but really that started to shape kind of the way classes were designed and informed. And so it made me curious when you kind of agreed to come on the show, what would you say is Grimke's kind of theological approach or what is kind of their big idea when you're designing curriculum or reviewing syllabi? What is it you're trying to make sure happens?
Yeah, so our moniker is Pastors Training Pastors. So one of the so you see two things that are really unique from that slogan. One is we have guys who are currently pastoring, teaching all of our courses. We may bring in outside lecturers who are 100%, you know, profs, academics. That's fine. This is not our way of being condescending. It's more of a particular focus that we have of really feeling kind of a gap out there in theological training, that it's getting so broad and so wide, and there's such a disconnect from professor classroom to local church life, that we just wanted to strengthen. So we want to be theologically driven, qualified to teach pastors, but that's one uniqueness. As the school grows and as we develop more curriculum, it's not to say we would never have a non-pastor teach. We will, but it's even those teachers, though, we want to be rooted in the church and very committed, you know, leaders in the church in some capacity. The other part is we're training pastors, and so we've immediately narrowed our audience to either pastors or aspiring pastors. And back when I went to seminary, I thought that's the only people who went to seminary. And when I started teaching seminary at New Orleans and then at Southeastern in North Carolina, I remember about a third of my class wanted to preach every week. And that kind of struck me as a bit strange. They wanted to do a great number of wonderful things, but they just weren't pastor preacher types. And that really changes the dynamic of a classroom that's going to be focused on preaching. And so what is unique and special right now at Grimke within our currently our only degree program, which is a Master of Theology degree, we're going to build more programs. And so we'll probably have a wider audience in due time. In fact, I know we will. But right now that MTS is exclusively for pastors and aspiring pastors. And so it's kind of like the old Spurgeon College, Spurgeon Pastors College, where you can put something on the whiteboard related to pastoral ministry or how this passage in Mark's gospel relates to ministry, and it can go for an hour because these guys are so engaged and so interested in what we have to say because it's going to impact them immediately. And so that's a philosophically one aspect that's unique, but I should mention a few other things. The delivery model is unique. So we have intensives twice a semester that are on site. Those are for 3 days. So it's kind of a three-pronged approach. The second prong is their own independent study that they will do where they're at, which will involve a lot of reading and a lot of writing. And then thirdly, every student has to meet with their pastor to discuss what they're reading and what they're learning. So there's like an MOU at the beginning of the semester on how they plan to do that. If they are the pastor, we have coaches at Grimke that will meet and coach. And so the philosophy is we don't want to pull people out of their churches to come to seminary. We really would like for them to stay in their church and get education, but we don't want them to just do an online thing. So we have kind of a hybrid approach where you don't have to relocate. It's really about your local church. Your pastor almost becomes a prof in some way, almost like a faculty member, and just kind of being hands-on and guiding, you know, the student through their reading, talking about how that would apply in their context, that sort of thing. So I guess in some ways it's like a beefed up internship, a beefed up, you know, residency. We found that some churches already have residencies, and so they're just going to use Grimke because we have the syllabi. Students come for the intensive. Sometimes the pastors have been coming with their guys. And so the approach is quite different. It's also very affordable. We're trying to reach especially kind of the urban types and those who can't afford to relocate and can't afford, honestly, a traditional seminary degree without some really big sacrifices. And so because we're not trying to reach a certain number of students and we're not all about the bottom line, we can keep costs low. And because our profs are pastors, first and foremost, we don't have a huge budget for professors or anything like that. And so we're seeing a lot of guys, I think, that would probably not go to, they wouldn't relocate and move their family to go to seminary. They might do the online approach, which is, again, better than nothing. And I'm not poo-pooing online stuff, but there's just something about the embodiment, the being together, and the intensives have been just incredible experiences. We start the morning in worship. We eat our meals together. We do four blocks of classes a day, and then we end the day in worship all together. We kind of borrowed from Bonhoeffer's approach to seminary that was kind of a life together model. And it's just been a great joy, man. The degree is achievable. You know, guys, we pitch it as this. You can do it in 2 years for $10,000, a 48-hour master's degree. And that's hard to come by. anywhere you go. If you don't want to do a specialization, you can do a 36-hour degree. But yeah, after the first year, man, we didn't know we were going to start it the year the pandemic was going to hit. But even so, the Lord has been gracious and faithful. We'll have our first graduating class next semester, and we're super excited about that. Once we graduate that class, we'll start the accreditation process,
okay,
which can't happen until you have a graduating class. And so we're pretty pumped about all of it, man.
That's awesome. That's so cool. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, is accreditation. So you answered it right there. We have one of our worship guys from one of our church plants coming starting in the fall. So I'm really excited to kind of, I told him, man, you got to, like, I want to see the syllabi. I want to see what you're learning. I'm excited for him to come.
Hopefully you can come with him, man.
That'd be great. I'd love to.
Yeah.
Kind of one of the questions I had related to it is, you've talked about being friends with Michael Burt. He wrote a systematic theology. I think it was evangelical theology. And I loved it because he has some humor spiced in. It doesn't read dry. Of course, my favorite is John Frames. But I think Burt's approach is really fun. I took his chapter on communion, and I actually printed out the section on the table, even though I personally don't necessarily land there right now. But I shared it with our staff because I was just trying to give them a different perspective on what it looks like to have maybe an open table or something like that. But that's a roundabout way of kind of asking my question, which is, at Grimke, is there a systematic theology that students are working through during their time there, or no?
Yeah, so I would have to ask Brian Lachlan what his current text is. I know the original syllabi I looked at, we were using Michael Horton's systematic, but I also commended Bird's that second edition to Brian, and I know he was looking at it. I don't know if he's pulled the trigger on using it yet, but I agree. I like the, the as you said, the humor in the book. It's a fun read. But it's I like the gospel centrality component, where he's tying each section back to the gospel, which sounds very obvious to do. But it's less topical and more kind of gospel center. And then he has room for debate, as you've indicated, like on the Lord's Supper, on particular issues. And so in a school like Grimke, which we're not denominationally affiliated, we have all kinds of guys who are coming to our school, some out of more charismatic bents, some presbys, some Baptists. And so we kind of need a book that we can, have those charitable discussions where the author is not going to be overly dogmatic about tertiary, secondary doctrines. So I really like his text, man.
For sure. Yeah. And I enjoy how he lays out his theological method right up front, whereas a lot of systematics may not do that. I remember reading Horton's, and it had a similar kind of feel, almost narrative. But yeah, that's kind of the last thing I wanted to kind of get your insight on is your latest book on church membership. Now, church membership is something I've written papers on. I've researched a lot of, because for some reason it is the burr in the saddle of my ministry. It is just the thing that gets people agitated, and I don't know if it's particular, especially in a culture in the West, Western United States and Boulder, where very, very independently minded people, and the idea of kind of covenanting or submitting yourself to a local church in the form of membership, it just seems to always get a rise. And so I've had to adapt to make sure I'm not they're not hearing me say something I'm not, but I'm still very strongly committed to the importance of church membership. What was kind of the reason you felt it important to write a book on church membership? Love Your Church. Why was it important for you to write this book?
Yeah, so I agree with you. We have a strong view of church membership here. The book is really about, the title, Love Your Church, and the subtitle, 8 Great Things About Being a Church Member.
Cool.
So it really assumes church membership. I talk about it a little bit in the opening section of the book, just some really quick arguments for the need for church membership. I don't argue for a particular process that every church needs to implement or anything like that, but just that people are identifiable, that church discipline assumes we know who is in our number, the lists that are in the New Testament, various other passages, passage of overseer is going to give an account for those under their care, That means people need to be knowable, identifiable. I'm really just building on, it's more of the assumption of church membership. What's great about being a church member? Less about the argument for it. Gotcha. I find that those books are great if you're a church leader, because you're going to need to be convincing people of the need for church membership, right? But I didn't have a great book. There were some books that I should say that were good, but I wanted a book I would give our new members.
Right.
What is it that I want them to know? What's so great about being a church member? And so Tabidi has a good book about a healthy church member. That Tom Rainer has a book that was helpful. I wanted to write something that would carry more, I guess you would say, I don't want to say Acts 29, but more of the Acts 29 culture and spirit of being missional. And so one of the eight things, the number eight is sending. And these are eight really responsibilities and privileges of church members, trying to convey both, that it's a great privilege to belong to Christ and to his body, but it also comes with responsibilities. But sending is not something that a lot of church members are taught about. That one of our responsibilities is to start new churches, to multiply. And so I wanted to put that in the book. There are some other unique aspects of it within the book. But I wanted to write something that would also be joyful, that would not come across as a domineering pastor, you know, self-serving pastor wants us to be committed to this thing, and don't you know there are problems in the church and all those kinds of things. But more of, man, we need to understand the grace of God that has been given to us, and to know Christ and to be known by other people in the church. And it's really a privilege to do these things. Chapter one's on belonging. Chapter two is welcoming. So trying to convey this idea of, we want to be a welcoming people as people come in. Chapter three is on gathering, which is especially significant right now as kind of a lot of churches are reopening. And so the book's timeless. I didn't write it with COVID in mind, but it's timely in that we really do have, this need to cast vision, a fresh vision for people on why all of this is important.
Right.
Chapter four is caring. Five is serving. Six is honoring. Seven is witnessing. And eight is sending. And so I'm just talking about some of these basics. That's not an exhaustive list of responsibilities in the church. And I hope it's useful. Hope it's encouraging. Hope it gives people, some clarity on the life of the church. One of my friends says this is, a lot of books talk about church polity or church structure or argument for church membership, and those are great. This is more about, I guess, the spirit and life of the church, of what does it mean to be, to love your church? How can I love my church? What if it's hard to love my church? What if I've been hurt by the church? All of those considerations are taken up. And so it's interesting, man, you asked about the kind of the origin behind it. I didn't set out to write a book on church membership. I was asked originally to write a book on the church. And so I was going to write a book kind of around the idea of gospel, community, and mission. And as we got into it, I had a hard time putting my finger on what the thesis was that I was driving at. And long story short, the editors helped me just think through, hey, we have an agenda. We want people to love Christ and love the church. That's what we're talking about. Just tell them how to love their church.
That's great.
And I was like, let's do it. And I'm like, that's actually a church membership book. And they're like, yes, it is. And so it all kind of shaped up through conversation. As most books do, it's not the single idea of a brilliant author, but a community effort, right?
That's great. I love that. That's something I'll be looking forward to, because I've bought Tabidi's and Tom's. And I use them to kind of riff off and create some stuff for our church. And so I'm sure it'll be a real blessing, not only to me, but other guys as well, to just gift people, as they become members at a church, just to remind them of the importance. And like you mentioned, the embodied nature, one thing that was, whether you call it a blessing, I mean, everything from God is a blessing, of course, but from 2020, where we were forced to go online, is it made me really reconsider my priors and my convictions about, what is online church and what are the limitations of that, and how do I communicate that in a gracious way, but also a clear way to convictionally call people to be like, you can't just listen to a podcast in a car and some worship songs and call it churchy. The embodied reality. And that's why even doing a podcast like this where we're over video, there's something lost where we don't get to connect in the same way. And so I think it's, like you said, it's going to be really timely for people, really helpful.
Yeah, amen, bro. That people have to be taught these things. We can't be mad at people for not having thought about them. You know, in one sense, I get paid to learn. You know, that's part of my job is to be a learner. And so we should always be gracious on these things, but firm where it's where you know when we have to be and speak the truth in love. You know, Jesus didn't just zoom a message from heaven. He came in person, embodied. The Word became flesh. I love at the end of John's letters when he says, I have much more to say to you, but I don't want to use pen and ink. I want to be with you in person. And then he adds, so that our joy may be filled.
That's right.
And I think that's significant, man. Like there is something missing. There is a lack of joy when it's not embodied. We are embodied people. And so, again, these are just things that I needed to be taught. And these are things that I have the privilege of teaching others.
That's great. Kind of last question I have for you before we kind of close out, and it's more of a personal question for ministry. So pastor to pastor, Grimke's kind of ethos, kind of your heart for ministry. As I've kind of, we're year 10 on our church, trying to figure out how to pastor people well, one of the issues that comes up pretty frequently is you have people that become members at your church, and then for whatever reason, good or bad, they decide, I'm not going to be a member here anymore. Either I'm going to not go to church anymore, or I'm going to go find a new church. How do you advise people on that? You know, if somebody were to call you and say, I'm at Chase's church, I'm thinking about leaving. How would you help them kind of navigate that?
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a few things as painful as there than that. I would tell them to go meet with a pastor. So I'll speak from personal testimony. A couple months ago, a couple been our church, been great members, considering leaving our church and finding another church. Heartbreaking, heart-wrenching, but they were meeting with me and another pastor. But we said, you know what? In the words of Paul, we're not lording over your faith. We are workers with you for your joy. And you're not leaving Jesus if you leave our church. And that's the good news. And I think often we kind of feel that way, or at least I do, that, man, they're leaving us. Like, why? Yeah. But they're not leaving him. And sometimes there may be good reasons, but we just said, we want you to flourish. We're not going to try to talk you out of this. Right. Let's hear your complaints, you know, and let's reason together. Yep. And let's see if there's some misunderstanding, if there's some miscommunication. And often, man, in those meetings, things get cleared up and people do kind of have a change of heart. Sometimes they don't, but at least I would say to the church member, you owe it to the pastor not to just peace out. And the pastor would love to hear from you. It's hard sometimes because we live in a world in which you can just cancel your Netflix subscription, just cancel your gym subscription online, and why not do the same with the church, you know? But if you have a membership process where you're covenanting together, you're a family together, out for the good of one another, then it seems right and good and wise to want to have those conversations. We've had to track people down sometimes, you know, that are emailing us and, hey, we're going to move on. Well, let's at least have a talk where I'm not going to try to talk you out of this. I just want to hear from you. And we want to ensure that you're going to a gospel church. And so that's another component, right? We want to, if we release someone here, we call it releasing in good standing. So they're joining a like-minded gospel church. But it's hard to have what can be some awkward conversations, but that's part of our discipleship process, you know?
For sure. Yeah. God has really, put my, how do you say it? Just kind of put my face right in the fire, over the church planting journey on this topic, particularly. And 2020 finally broke me in a lot of ways of that, unhealthy attachment where I'd made a lot of mistakes with my mouth, towards people and the way I kind of was like, you can't leave, that kind of thing. And when you find yourself getting in a position where you're trying to convince people to stay, people, that's not a healthy way to lead, you know, and that's not the way church should be. Can I try to like reason, like you said, with people? Sure. But yeah, that thankfully by God's grace, I feel like I've grown a lot in that. That doesn't mean I'm not done yet, but like you said, you know, just trying to meet with people, hear from them, and send them out appropriately. But thank God truly that when somebody emails me, I just had somebody 2 weeks ago say, "Hey, I'm moving on." My heart didn't, it was sad, but it wasn't, unbearable. It was kind of like, okay, I understand people leave and that's okay. And that's a real grace to me.
Yes. And this has been an extra hard year, to, you know, in this respect, yes, we've dealt with a lot. And, sometimes we don't think our, you know, the folks are thinking with good discernment. And that adds a layer of grief to it. I've been encouraged going through 2 Corinthians. We're preaching through it right now, just how Paul and the Corinthians have such a complicated relationship. And he's having to defend himself. He doesn't want to defend himself, but he's doing it so they won't, you know, go the way of the super apostles. And it's like he planted the church and some 10 years later doesn't know if he even wants to go visit them, you know. So ministry is hard, man. It's messy and relationships are complicated and awkward, but you know, we press on and we trust as you know, that God is sovereignly refining us through all of this. And I think plurality is really important, and community for pastors. You've got other pastors you can talk about with these emotional hurts and the mental anguish, and to have good brothers and sisters in community as best you can, to be in a network, you know, like Acts 29, where you can get on the phone and talk to a guy who's dealing with very similar things. And, you know, they're like, "How do you deal with it?" And I'm like, "Well, I only answer emails when I'm in a good mood. I only open it. I don't open it on Sunday or Monday. I am so reluctant. I try not to look at an email."
That's funny.
I just know I've got them coming every
email. That's great. Well, Tony, it's been so great to chat with you. And thanks for sharing some of your story, your heart, your kind of perspective on things. If people wanted to hear more, obviously, they can check out your church. You have a website. I think it's tonymarita.com. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a little old school. It's tonymarita.net.
.net.
Yeah. That's couldn't great. Get the .com. Somebody had it. yeah, church website, idcraleigh.com. Imago Dei Church, idcraleigh.com. And then grimkeseminary.org.
Cool. That's great. And then Love Your Church, that's on Amazon or anywhere else books are sold. Is that right?
That is correct.
That's great, man. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for tuning in today and checking out our conversation here with Tony. Our next episode hopefully will be with Jeff Metters, who is a pastor down in Houston, connected with Acts 29, coming up in July, as we're kind of slow rolling it here over the summer. But until then, we hope to see you next time.